heard up to my right a loud roar, and I saw there was a water buffalo that had been hit with shrapnel and a big 3-foot gash in its belly. And then I looked to the left and I saw just a sea of bodies, and probably 100 to 120 corpses. Few of them were moving, most of them were still. This was 15 minutes after the bomb.
You are listening to the On Genocide audio blog. My name is Kieran. This is a series of lectures devoted to extending the understanding of genocide, a term which has systematically been stripped of its meaning over time in order to sanitize the most heinous and brutal acts of genocide in the post-World War II era. The central thesis is that, in either scholarly or common sense terms, major US military actions in Korea, Indochina, and Iraq are more suited to the term genocide than the term war. This requires considerable explanation and elaboration, but in simple terms, the US systematically kills more civilians than armed enemies and inflicts far more damage on non-military than military targets. The focus of US energies is not on the neutralization of an opposing military force, but rather on mass killing and the destruction of the social, economic, cultural, political, and religious foundations of life. This is exactly the strategic behavior that the term genocide was coined to describe. This does not occur with the willing, consensual participation of the vast majority of US personnel, but rather occurs through the subversion of what such personnel believe to be conventional politico-military efforts. In contemporary terms, the most familiar symptom of this is the recurrent situation wherein military personnel are forced to kill civilians in order to maintain a sense of safety. Each lecture in this series will be accompanied by a text which will be available at the blog site ongenocide.wordpress.com. These will often be audio or video files, and I recommend that these be viewed or read or listened to in advance of each lecture. Welcome to the introductory lecture of the On Genocide audio blog. In this lecture, I will first be describing the motives that led me to begin this project, and from there I will continue with an overview of the lecture series. After this, I will broach the subject of the meaning of genocide. Now, nearly every single full-length volume on the subject of genocide begins with a section titled The Meaning of Genocide. In this lecture, I'm not going to give a full definition of genocide, but rather I will introduce the topic and then propose that until a subsequent lecture, when genocide can be defined, that a temporary common-sense definition be adopted. The definition being that for our current purposes, genocide is defined as the deliberate, systematic mass killing of civilians. From there, I will proceed with a survey of prior incidents in which the US has committed genocide on these terms. I will begin with the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century, then turn to Allied bombing policies in World War II, and finally describe events in Korea. For events in Indochina, I would refer the listener to the lecture's set text. This extraordinary speech, part of which could be heard over the music of Mountain Eater at the beginning of this lecture, was given by S. Brian Wilson, and I would urge listeners to seek out his blog and to check out the autobiography of this remarkable person, which is entitled Blood on the Tracks. I should also give a plug here to Mountain Eater, whose music I use. They're on SoundCloud, Facebook, and MySpace, and links are given on the at the On Genocide blog, ongenocide.wordpress.com. So, I'll begin by describing my reasons for beginning this lecture series. Back in 2003, I was watching events unfold in the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, and I was labouring under a serious delusion. I didn't believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and I didn't believe that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. What is more, I knew that US and UK leaders were deliberately lying about weapons of mass destruction. The delusion I was labouring under was about what the US would do in Iraq. I thought, and I was not alone in this, that the US would wreak maximum havoc, declare itself triumphal, and leave behind a complete mess, and then blame the victims when Iraq descended into chaos. Of course, some might say this is a very accurate description of what eventually did happen, but that happened over a period of years, whereas I was envisaging a period of months. At the time, however, I was reading various works about events in Indochina. I had already made tentative conclusions about the US conduct of military actions in Indochina, particularly South Vietnam, and began to see parallels as the occupation of Iraq unfolded. I continued to follow events in Iraq as I was researching and writing a piece about the Second Indochina War. In both instances, it became very clear that US was not fighting a war as it is generally understood. On many levels, US actions were more likely to nurture than to defeat their putative enemies. As I was working on events in Indochina, I came across a work specifically about this phenomenon by an author called David Keane, who referred to such a situation as a war system. His work referred to the global war on terror, but it was astonishingly applicable to the Second Indochina War. I should note here that the Second Indochina War is what is referred to in the Western world as being the Vietnam War, or what the Vietnamese refer to as the American War. There are a number of reasons why referring to these events as the Second Indochina War is preferable, and certainly key among them is the fact that a great deal of action occurred and many lives were lost in Laos and Cambodia. Anyway, Keane's war system is characterized above all by counterproductive behaviors. In Iraq and in South Vietnam, one can summarize the most significant counterproductive behaviors as being those that act to recruit enemies, to provide arms to enemies, to provide finance to enemies. This is striking behavior and fundamental, but I would also add that creating and maintaining a strategic environment and tactical environments which allow the enemy to make armed attacks is an equally fundamental part of a US engendered war system. Now, the word genocide has been associated with the US and Indochina since before I was born. In writing a thesis about Indochina, I had satisfied myself that genocide was an applicable word, and I applied it. However, I was still partly using a paradigm wherein genocide was a form of moral condemnation, and it was as if US actions were sufficiently bad that they had crossed some invisible line which qualified them for the label genocide. Thus, I called the Second Indochina War a genocidal war system. What I came to realize was that in itself, genocide is a powerful analytical term. Genocide is not only an appropriate term, but an extremely revealing and edifying paradigm through which to view US military actions. You see, Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, spent decades puzzling over historical incidents of what he would come to call genocide. The advent of the German occupation of Europe was to make clear to him the true dimensions of this topic, and lead to his coinage. In Lemkin's own words, "Generally speaking, genocide does not necessarily mean the immediate destruction of a nation except when accomplished by mass killings of all members of a nation. It is intended rather to signify a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of the essential foundations of life of national groups, with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. The objectives of such a plan would be the disintegration of the political and social institutions, of culture, language, national feelings, religion, and the economic existence of national groups, and the destruction of the personal security, liberty, health, dignity, and even the lives of the individuals belonging to such groups. Genocide is directed against the national group as an entity, and the actions involved are directed against individuals, not in their individual capacity, but as members of the national group. I will return to Lemkin at a later date, but at this stage I will say that genocide is a term which can be advisedly applied to US military actions, and that doing so is appropriate and useful on an intellectual level. For obvious reasons, however, it is politically unacceptable to apply the term genocide in these cases. Genocide is not easily morally defended, and the lens of genocide does not allow for moral numbness with which the public is confronted by so-called collateral damage. One can inure oneself to an innocent infant dying in fear and agony if it is the unfortunate byblow of a process, but not if it is the process itself. That is public sentiment, of course, but we would do well to remember that these things are not necessarily so in policy circles, where many take pride in their macho, hard-nosed lack of sentimentality. Reflecting on exactly this sort of situation, and on the use of language, in 1945 George Orwell wrote, "Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan, can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face, and which do not square with the professed aims of the political parties. Thus political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenceless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification." Well, genocide was the unmentionable reality replaced by euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. But that was not enough. The term genocide was itself subjected to the process that Orwell himself made famous a few years after writing that. The meaning of the word genocide was systematically destroyed and replaced with double plus bad. That meant that only officially designated double plus bad people could commit genocide. As Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky wrote in Manufacturing Consent, we can even read who are the US friends and enemies from the media's use of the word. I will, of course, be dealing with this topic at greater length, but I will point out here that I imagine that it will be quite shocking to most listeners to find out the extent to which genocide scholars have ignored, misused, abused, and distorted the historical record in order to redefine genocide as something that people of color in poor countries do to each other. The problem is that in the academic world, any moral condemnation is considered intellectually suspect. There is a catch-22 situation, which is a great deal more powerful when you confront it than it may seem from the outside. There is a lot I would like to say on this subject, but I will leave that for another time. Suffice it to say that applying the term genocide to US actions is polemical, political, and suspect, not an accepted analytical approach. In contrast, it is perfectly acceptable to make ludicrous and quite moronic analyses based on the alleged realism wherein a monolithic US undertakes violent acts in response to real or imagined military threats. When it turns out, for example, that there were no WMD, the paradigm isn't changed, but rather the defect is attributed to policymakers who are either stupid or fanatical or controlled by a global Zionist conspiracy through AIPAC. According to this line of thought, the US has been making mistake after mistake after mistake for more than 60 years, often exactly the same mistakes repeated over and over. There is a liberal version of this too, such that realists claim that US has failed in its aim to fight terror, and the liberals claim that the US has failed in its aim to spread democracy. Of course US politicians claim to be fighting terror and spreading democracy, but in the final analysis, that's all the evidence there is, the word of politicians, not a group of people that most of us consider to be very reliable in the honesty stakes. In the end, however, that is what these very respectable and orthodox analyses have as a fundamental basis. So, I'm already caught in that to apply genocide to US actions makes me a polemicist, not an analyst, a lesser being far below the lofty intellectual heights inhabited by those who do not allow their political feelings to pollute their analysis. The only option is to enter one of the academic ghettos available for foolish dissidents such as myself in fields like development studies, peace studies, gender studies, and the like. Places looked down upon by the real men of such topics as international relations, economics, or anything that has the word strategic in it. Or I could go into a critical studies area, adding something perhaps of value to discourse studies, or doing critical genocide studies. In order to give some idea of the sorts of traps that can be fallen into by defining genocide, and also to give some idea of the general tenor of the scholarly discourse of genocide, I'll give the example of a definition given in 1990 by Frank Chalk and Kurt Jonasson. They wrote that genocide is a form of one-sided mass killing in which a state or other authority intends to destroy a group as that group and membership in it are defined by the perpetrator. This is a well-respected and influential definition, which comes from their 1990 volume, The History and Sociology of Genocide. But when we come to examine it part by part, what seems at first to be sound is soon revealed to be extremely slippery. It begins by defining genocide as a form of one-sided mass killing. This is in itself extremely problematic. What exactly qualifies as being one-sided? Every single perpetrator of genocide, and every genocide denier, will claim that there was mutual violence. According to Chalk and Jonasson, in genocide, the victim group has no organized military machinery that might be opposed to that of the perpetrator. End quote. Does this mean we should exclude those Jews killed in the partisan warfare who were conventionally accepted as victims of the Shoah? What about those killed in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising? What level of opposition should be considered? In fact, what the authors seem to be suggesting is that the existence of armed resistance of any form means that even non-combatant victims are not actually victims of a genocide. But do civilians really ever have a means of opposition, or even soldiers under heavy bombardment? Above all, what purpose is served by introducing this subjective conditionality that has no relevance to the original conception of genocide? The next matter is the unnecessarily defined perpetrator, the state or other authority. Now, I can understand observing that a state or other authority is, in all known cases, the perpetrator of genocide, and I'd probably agree with that as an observation. But why would anyone make it a defining characteristic? As I will discuss at a later time, in many academic definitions subsequent to this one, the nature of the perpetrator becomes a central defining characteristic, a crucial step in ensuring that we don't start accusing people of genocide unless we know that they are bad people. Finally, we have intends to destroy a group as that group and membership in it are defined by the perpetrator. The obvious reasons for using this formulation wherein the group is defined by the perpetrator is to avoid the exclusion of certain groups. It is unfair, such people argue, to exclude groups just because they do not fit the UN Convention definition. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Well, no. In fact, it's complete rubbish. It shows how much we have become conditioned to view genocide as a term of moral opprobrium, namely double plus blad, rather than a description of a type of crime, leaving aside, until some other time, the separate moral question of threatening human diversity. The moral significance of the crime comes from the suffering visited on its victims. Genocide tends to produce the most horrendous crimes for a whole lot of structural reasons, but any given mass killing of individuals based on political criteria, which is known as politicide, may cause greater human suffering, and this may be an arguably greater crime than a given genocide. It gets worse because the intends to destroy a group phrase is absolute, as opposed to the destruction in whole or in part featured in the UN Convention. No significantly sized human group is completely delineable. There are always liminal cases. The Germans, for example, struggled considerably with defining what a Jew was in racial terms, and it is sobering to reflect that even to the extent that they could define what a Jew was, they did not even intend to destroy that entire group. Now, if one were to say Polish Jews, for example, they most certainly did intend to destroy that group, and one could add many to that list, but since the policy based itself on a fictitious racial notion, the group as that group and membership in it are defined by the perpetrator is exactly what they did not intend to destroy, except, of course, in part. Indeed, not only do genocide perpetrators have the same struggle in defining groups, but they also deliberately conflate, confuse, and defy categorization in order to bring about the mass acquiescence and to mobilize those whose task it is to commit the violent acts themselves. To return to the German example, the Shoah arose out of many things, including the brutalization of the Great War and the eugenic theories which had already led the regime to murder its own mentally ill and intellectually disabled. More than that, however, it came from hatred and fear of Jews. Much of this was traditional and ultimately Christian in origin. But during their reign, the Nazis amplified this fear and hatred by associating Judaism with criminality, with Bolshevism, with effeminacy, and with terrorism. This was deliberately vague. I dare say if you'd asked a German whether all Jews were terrorists or all terrorists were Jews, they would have said no. But if you'd mentioned a communist terrorist, they would almost inevitably picture a Jew. As I will detail later, when German troops invaded the Soviet Union, they were conditioned to commit genocide. Yes, they did have a real war to fight against a real enemy, and the partisans were also a real enemy. But their heads were full of the imagery of the Jewish Bolshevik terrorists with Slavs and the concept of the subhuman thrown into a schizophrenic mix. If I switch now to Indochina, I can survey how such conditioning affected US personnel. The enemy in this case was Charlie, which comes from Charlie Tango, which stood for Communist Terrorists. But there was the racial confusion. In training, the gooks were the enemy and the enemy was the gooks. Confusing when your supposed allies were also gooks. Finally, there was the VC, the Viet Cong, a term that altered during the war until it became nothing more than a signifier of people we don't like, and finally, anything associated with people we don't like. The end result was seen at My Lai, where a massacre began at about 8 in the morning. And as Joanna Bork wrote, by the time Kelly and his men sat down to lunch, they had rounded up and slaughtered around 500 unarmed civilians. Within those hours, members of Charlie Company had, quote, fooled around, end quote, and laughed as they sodomized and raped women, ripped vaginas open with knives, bayoneted civilians, scalped corpses, and carved C Company, or the Ace of Spades, onto chests. They slaughtered animals and torched hooches. Other soldiers had wept openly as they fired on crowds of unresisting old men, women, children, and babies. At no stage did these soldiers receive any enemy fire or encounter any form of resistance save fervent pleadings. Yet they were only obeying orders, doing their duty, and, they reasoned, even little babies could be Viet Cong. I thought, Paul Meadlow testified, they had some sort of chain or a little string. They had to give a little pull and they'd blow us up. Kelly's platoon began killing individually, before Kelly ordered the first coordinated killings. As A.J. Langeth described, Vietnamese screamed as the bullets tore through their bodies and ripped into their heads. Meadlow kept his rifle on automatic. He reloaded a magazine of bullets, fired on semi-automatic, and paused to reload again. Instead, he stopped. Tears running down his cheeks, he pressed his rifle on Conti, You shoot them. Conti shoved the rifle away and pointed at Kelly. Let him do it, he said. By then, it hardly mattered. Only a few children had survived, sheltered by their mothers. As the dazed children tried to stand, Kelly picked them off one by one. When they were all dead, he turned away. To Conti, he looked calm. Okay, Kelly said, let's go. From that point, the platoon began herding other villagers into a drainage ditch, where they were to be shot. At one point, a two-year-old boy climbed out of the ditch, and Kelly threw him back in before shooting him. Kelly later explained his understanding of his actions. The old men, the women, the children, the babies were all VC, or would be VC in about 3 years. And inside of VC women, I guess there were about 1,000 little VC now. Kelly was aberrant, yes, but not that aberrant. Nor was My Lai in any sense an isolated incident. Though not on this scale, massacres by US personnel were extremely common. More to the point, however, higher up the chain of command, the banal version of Kelly's thinking was common. The most famous and infamous US commander in South Vietnam was notorious for saying that Asian life was plentiful and cheap. In 1969, he also stated that no civilian had ever been killed in a free-fire zone because, by definition, no one who chose to remain in a declared free-fire zone was a civilian. That meant that this man, William Westmoreland, believed in VC babies just as much as Kelly did. Westmoreland killed a lot more babies and toddlers than Kelly ever could. So this conflation of imagery which produces the chimerical enemy whose parts are interchangeable is central in getting soldiers to commit genocide, while you keep telling them they are fighting a war, which is universally the case where soldiers are used to commit genocide, which is to say most genocides. Returning to the definition which led to this digression, if we remove anything that is unwarranted or unwanted, we actually get a definition that reads, genocide is a form of mass killing, which tells us very little. The question that needs to be asked is why, 50 years after Lemkin arrived at a sophisticated term with a considerable theoretical weight, did two scholars come up with a definition which means, more or less, nothing? Part of the answer lies in the politics of Western and Soviet imperialism, but another lies in the horrors of the German extermination camps and their power to defy analysis. Bear in mind that Lemkin himself did not know about the gas chambers and crematoria, though he knew that the Germans had killed millions of innocents, including millions of Jews. So you can see some of the pitfalls in coming up with new definitions of genocide already. When I do define genocide, I will stick very closely to Lemkin's ideas and what is contained in the UN Convention. In the meantime, however, I propose using a common-sense definition of genocide, which I've heard used particularly with respect to Indochina. Some people who came to believe from their experiences that the US engaged in the deliberate and systematic mass killing of non-combatants instinctively sought for a word to describe that practice, and the word they came up with was genocide. For the purposes of what I wish to discuss, this is a completely serviceable definition. In any instance of the deliberate systematic mass killing of non-combatants by a foreign force, it will inevitably fill the criteria to be considered genocide, while any other forms of genocide are not a central concern of this lecture series and can await elaboration at a later date. Additionally, I want to use this definition because I want there to be no doubt in anyone's mind that if it is demonstrated that the US is guilty of genocide, that this means full-fledged genocide, not something that is technically qualified as genocide but isn't really the same as the real brutal genocides such as happened in Cambodia and Rwanda. To that end, I am now going to detail some instances in which the US has systematically and deliberately killed civilians. Beginning first with the Philippines, then talking about some of its actions during World War II, and then talking about Korea. So, when the US annexed the Philippines at the end of 1898, and during the vicious military suppression campaign that followed, they deployed infantilizing tropes. President McKinley referred to bringing Christian civilization to the Little Brown Brothers to justify a takeover of the strategic country. Of course, this was a country that had been Catholic for a long time and knew all about Christianity already. But anyway, in terms inescapably reminiscent of the rhetoric of the occupation of Iraq, he asked himself, can we leave these people who, by the fortunes of war and our own acts, are helpless and without government to chaos and anarchy after we have destroyed the only government they have had? He answered, having destroyed their government, it is the duty of the American people to provide for a better one. The president dismissed as unpatriotic any suggestion that the American people were incapable of creating a new government for others. He told a group of Methodist ministers the following with regard to his decision to acquire the Philippines. I walked the floor of the White House night after night until midnight, and I am not ashamed to tell you, gentlemen, that I went down on my knees and prayed Almighty God for light and guidance more than one night. And one night late it came to me this way. I don't know how it was, but it came. One, that we could not give them back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. Two, that we could not turn them over to France or Germany, our commercial rivals in the Orient. That would be bad business and discreditable. Three, that we could not leave them to themselves. They were unfit for self-government, and they would have soon had anarchy and misrule over there worse than Spain's was. And four, that there was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them, and by God's grace do the very best we could by them, as our fellow men for whom Christ also died. And then I went to bed and went to sleep and slept soundly. William Bloom remarks on this quote, William McKinley's idea of doing the very best by the Filipinos was to employ the United States Army to kill them in tens of thousands, burn down their villages, subject them to torture, and lay the foundations for an economic exploitation which was proudly referred to at the time as imperialism by leading American statesmen and newspapers. As Howard Zinn points out, the Filipinos did not get the same message from God that McKinley did, and many rose up in resistance to U.S. rule. General Arthur MacArthur, who was soon to become military governor of the Philippines, admitted in 1899, I have been reluctantly compelled to believe that the Filipino masses are loyal to Aguinaldo and the government which he heads. The government referred to here was formed by Emilio Aguinaldo, who led an anti-Spanish insurrection which took control of virtually the entire country before U.S. forces arrived. However, as Susan Brewer explained, then U.S. Army troops arrived, carrying instructions that they were not to share authority in the islands with the Filipinos. General Thomas N. Anderson sent Aguinaldo a message. General Anderson wishes you to inform your people that we are here for their good, and that they must supply us with labor and material at current market prices. Recognizing the Filipino people as the real threat, the American command worked out a deal with the Spaniards to stage a mock battle, the mock battle of Manila, on August 13, 1898, remembering that they had actually gone to the Philippines supposedly to fight the Spaniards. They would shoot at each other, and then Spain would surrender before the Philippine Army of Liberation could take part. The cruel repression thereafter meted out by the U.S. on those whose welfare it claimed to hold dear revealed the facility of racism exemplified by Kipling when, in The White Man's Burden, he wrote of new caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child. This poem, penned to encourage the U.S. to annex the Philippines, was a milestone in racism. As one work on racism puts it, his trope artfully combined a Darwinian emphasis on the competitive fitness of the white man with the suggestion of pseudo-paternalistic mission to uplift and improve the natives. But a paternalism which, however repugnant and hypocritical, was accepted broadly as being altruistic, transformed easily into hateful and violent racism. In the process, a narrative was formed where the aggressor became the victim, bitten by the savage Oriental when reaching out the hand of loving guidance. Racism fueled the atrocities of troops in the Philippines. According to Zinn, A volunteer from the state of Washington wrote, "Our fighting blood was up, and we all wanted to kill niggers. This shooting human beings beats rabbit hunting all to pieces." But when Albert Beveridge spoke in the Senate, he did not reference the viciousness of U.S. personnel. "It has been charged that our conduct of the war has been cruel. Senators, it has been the reverse. Senators must remember that we are not dealing with Americans or Europeans. We are dealing with Orientals." In other words, the violence and cruelty was because of the Oriental nature of the victim, not the nature of the perpetrator. As John Bellamy Foster recounts, at least 250,000 Filipinos were killed, mostly civilians. Villages were burned and their populations interned in concentration camps. There were, quote, "mass hangings and bayonettings of suspects, systematic rapings of women and girls, and torture." General Frederick Funston did not hesitate to announce that he had personally strung up a group of 35 Filipino civilians suspected of supporting Filipino revolutionaries. Major Edwin Glenn saw no reason to deny the charge that he'd made a group of 47 Filipino prisoners kneel and repent of their sins before bayoneting and clubbing them to death. General Jacob Smith orders his troops to kill and burn, to target everything over 10, and to turn the island of Samar into a howling wilderness. End quote. Foster goes on to note that according to U.S. official statistics, 15 times as many Filipinos were killed as were wounded. This was mainly due to the frequency of summary executions. At the end of 1900, General MacArthur declared rebels to be war traitors against the United States, who, if captured, are not entitled to the privileges of prisoners of war. Initial resistance to U.S. forces was conventional, but could not withstand the superior firepower of the U.S. In the very first battle, Admiral Dewey steamed up the Pasig River and fired 500-pound shells into the Filipino trenches. Dead Filipinos were piled so high that Americans used their bodies for breastworks. A British witness said, "This is not war, it is simply massacre and murderous butchery." The Filipinos therefore naturally turned to guerrilla warfare. The U.S. declared itself victorious in 1902, but resistance continued for many more years, even arguably until 1935, when Moro resistance ended. The U.S. prevailed against the guerrillas, but was it really the guerrillas that they were fighting? The U.S. had lost only 4,200 killed by 1902. U.S. forces had killed over 250,000, but most of their victims were civilians. Moreover, this massively understates the number of people who died as a result of U.S. actions. Now, I'm going to quote here from Mike Davis's excellent book, Late Victorian Holocaust. It's quite a long quote, and there's sub-quotes within it from an author called de Beauvoir. So I hope it's not too confusing, but I'll signal the quote is over. Quote, "The Americans exceeded even the cruelest Spanish precedents in manipulating disease and hunger as weapons against an insurgent but weakened population. Beginning with the outbreak of war in February 1899, military authorities closed all ports, disrupting the vital inter-island trade in foodstuffs and preventing the migration of hungry laborers to food surplus areas. Then, as drought began to turn into famine in 1900, they authorized the systematic destruction of rice stores and livestock in areas that continued to support guerrilla resistance. As historians would later point out, the ensuing campaign of terror against the rural population, backed up by a past system and population reconcentration, prefigured U.S. strategy in Vietnam during the 1960s. All Palais rice and storehouses clearly for use by enemy soldiers," writes de Beauvoir, "were to be destroyed. That plan would have caused hardship for the people even if it had been implemented as intended, since guerrillas and civilians often depended on the same rice stockpiles. But the food denial program got out of hand. Increasingly unsure who was enemy and who was friend, American soldiers on patrol did not agonize over such distinctions. They shot and burned indiscriminately, engaging in an orgy of destruction throughout the Philippines. As peasants began to die of hunger in the fall of 1900, American officers openly acknowledged in correspondence that starvation had become official military strategy. De Beauvoir concludes, "It appears that the American war contributed directly and indirectly to the loss of more than 1 million persons from a base population of about 7 million." And that's the end of the quote. The reality of the suffering inflicted by the U.S. was kept from the U.S. public. Brewer described how McKinley set up a number of precedents for perception management. The president called Filipino resistance an insurrection and described the war as a humanitarian mission. He pioneered the management of news coverage in his efforts to persuade Americans that a war to control an overseas colony did not violate their democratic principles. End quote. Note the deceptive term insurrection, which, like insurgency, means an uprising against an established order, not the resistance to the imposition of a new order. While the U.S. government ensured that the news from the Philippines was censored and promulgated distorted reports of success by the military, expansionists, led by McKinley, used a comprehensive campaign to sell the war to the U.S. public. Along with the racist tropes of the white man's burden, they held out the prospect of material enrichment, which was equally deceptive. According to Zinn, even some trade unions were persuaded by promises of exploitable resources and new markets for surplus goods. Quote, "On the other hand, when the Leather Workers' Journal wrote that an increase in wages at home would solve the problem of surplus by creating more purchasing power inside the country, the Carpenters' Journal asked, how much better off are the working men of England through all its colonial possessions? The National Labour Tribune, publication of the Iron, Steel and Tin Workers, agreed that the Philippines were rich with resources, but added, the same can be said of this country, but if anybody were to ask you if you owned a coal mine, sugar plantation or railroad, you would have to say no. All those things are in the hands of the trusts, controlled by a few." End quote. Even the moneyed elites of the U.S. had prominent anti-imperialists in their ranks, inspired not only by principle, but often by the certain knowledge that their own interests would be harmed by the acquisition of the Philippines, without even taking into account the impact of the expenditure of U.S. Treasury funds. Indeed, it proved that the Philippines did not bring any promised economic bonanza and remained a drain on U.S. resources. The Philippines War has been seen as a precursor for the Second Indochina War and then for the occupation of Iraq, which arguably displays more correspondences. Admittedly, one of the major features of the Philippines War, the confinement of the rural population to reconcentration camps, is absent from Iraq, where the largely urban population is already concentrated and dependent. However, the political situation, the propaganda used to create support for, the use of torture, the killing of civilians, and the destruction of access to basic human necessities are all reminiscent of the Philippines War. Howard Zinn, for example, emphasized the deception used to sell war on the U.S. public. Kurt Vonnegut compared shock and awe to the Moro massacre in 1906, when 900 men, women, and children were killed by U.S. troops who suffered only 15 fatalities, leading Mark Twain to bitterly declare, "This is incomparably the greatest victory that was ever achieved by Christian soldiers of the United States." More interesting than the critics of the Iraq occupation are those who support U.S. imperialism in terms of the white man's burden. It was the salutary mention, fittingly by British journalists and The Economist and on BBC television, that prompted John Bellamy Foster to revisit what actually occurred in the Philippines. He quotes from Max Boot's 2002, quote, "Glorification of U.S. Imperialist Wars," end quote, titled The Savage Wars of Peace, and that title comes from Kipling's White Man's Burden. Quote, and this is quoting Boot here, "By the standards of the day, the conduct of U.S. soldiers was better than average for colonial wars," end quote. Boot's bookends by decrying the failure of the U.S. to effect regime change in Iraq in 1991. But while the white man's burden is explicitly racial, and thus surprising to see revived, the underlying logic, and implicitly the racial element, is present in other concepts and practices, including the civilized mission, mandate, nation building, and the pottery barn rule. These will be discussed further at a later date, but it should be noted here that just because the white race is not mentioned, it does not mean that it's not an essential part of the thinking behind a proposal or its positive reception. For example, when, also in 2002, the National Review editor proposed for Iraq an enlightened paternalism premised on the idea that Arabs have failed miserably at self-government and need to start anew, the goal would be a pro-Western and reasonably successful regime somewhat between the Shah of Iran and the current government of Turkey, end quote. Hopefully that racism is reasonably obvious, but I will later be discussing the inherent racism, the concepts of Western liberalism and the elevation of Western society, of course, implies naturally that others have lesser values. Not that I have anything against Western values, it's just that we do rather have a tendency to judge the West on its ideal values, whereas we judge something like the Soviet Union on what it actually does, not on the wonderful values espoused by the Communist Party, which also had lovely values, particularly fond of their adherence to democracy, for example. Anyway, I will be discussing this sort of threat at depth at the time. But to forestall any sort of misapprehension that somehow US behavior arose out of the nature of guerrilla warfare, I should point out that it is not the case that US behaved in a particular way in the Philippines, Indochina, Iraq that is peculiar to those countries. Many of the US actions in these places have precedents so consistent that they could almost be considered doctrinal, evident particularly in the long US engagement in the Western Hemisphere. And one book I'd highly recommend to give you a sense of that would be Greg Grandin's Empire's Workshop. Now, turning to the war against Japan, I have to start by recommending a book by John Dower called War Without Mercy, which I'll be drawing on quite a lot here. Fighting in the Pacific was incredibly bitter, and there is no doubt that both sides engaged in atrocities. The Japanese military, taken as a whole, committed many, many atrocities throughout World War II. That's what maybe makes it all the more astonishing that the indications are that when taken in isolation, Allied troops in the Pacific committed more atrocities than the Japanese. It's not possible to quantify the incidents of torture, but in terms of the most common atrocity of wartime, killing prisoners, surrendering enemies, or those disabled by wounds, it is clear that the US far exceeded the normal levels caused by the brutality of war. According to Cox, in the taking of Attu, the body count totaled 2,351, but only 28 prisoners were taken, a ratio repeated throughout the Pacific War. It is true that the Japanese were sometimes ordered to fight to the death, but according to a US study, 84% of prisoners had, not unreasonably, expected death and or torture on capture, and that this was the primary reason for reluctance to surrender. Dower writes that, quote, neither Allied fighting men nor their commanders wanted any POWs. This was not official policy, but over wide reaches of the Asian battleground it was everyday practice. The Marine battle cry on Tarawa made no bones about this. Kill the Jap bastards, take no prisoners. Troops referred to themselves as rodent exterminators. When prisoners were taken, they were often massacred, perhaps leaving a few for intelligence purposes. In addition to torturing and killing prisoners, there was very widespread mutilation of corpses and the taking of trophy body parts. This became so normal that Life magazine featured a full-page photo of, quote, an attractive blonde posing with a Japanese skull she had been sent by her fiancé, end quote. Whilst it became routine for customs in Hawaii to ask if there were any bones in luggage, it was also common to extract gold teeth, sometimes from living Japanese. This was the context of race hatred that existed when the US began its major firebombing raids against Japanese cities. But we should also consider the bombing practices that had been unleashed in Europe as the war progressed. a controversial work by Eric Marcuson and David Kopf entitled The Holocaust and Strategic Bombing, Genocide and Total War in the 20th Century, very firmly places World War II bombing policies in the arena of genocide. The authors are not claiming a moral equivalence between Allied bombing policies and Axis genocides, but if you read this book, and I would highly recommend that you do, I guarantee that the parallels they reveal in the evolution of German thought leading to the final solution and in Allied thought leading to firebombing and ultimately atomic bombing will definitely disturb you. Three early advocates of mass aerial bombardment were Italy's Giulio Duhe, Hugh Trenchard in the UK, and Billy Mitchell, US. Duhet and Trenchard were against the distinction between civilian and combatant. Mitchell was an advocate of incendiary bombing, and all three argued that mass bombing of urban areas would shorten wars, preventing the horrors of drawn-out trench warfare. In this, one can see the shadow of the Great War as easily as one can see it in German genocide. In World War II, under Air Chief Marshal Arthur Bomber Harris, the British conducted what was termed terror bombing of civilians. The idea was that if you induced enough fear in the enemy population, it would turn against the war. This had begun with a phase in 1940 of what Marcuson and Kopf term the erosion of mutual restraint between Germany and Britain. This culminated first in the Blitz, and then in Britain choosing to prioritize industrial targets within residential areas, rather than those outside of residential areas. In the months after the end of the Blitz, Britain continued to expand targeting, in Marcuson and Kopf's words, to maximize collateral damage. Of course, at this stage, the deliberate targeting of civilians means that they weren't really collateral damage anymore, so you can't deliberately maximize collateral damage. But anyway, the bombings were costly in British lives and material, and they were all but suspended between November 1941 and February 1942. On resumption, the bombing was officially under the rationale of demoralizing the German people through what was euphemistically referred to as de-housing. What this actually meant was that killing civilians was itself the supposed means of demoralization, hence the term terror bombing. A great deal of forethought was given to ways into which to maximize the destruction and mortality, such as using a mixture of incendiaries, delayed action high explosive, and landmines in order to impede or kill firefighters. This, in itself, could be considered genocide, inasmuch as it seeks to destroy part of the nation through physically killing them. But there should also be some question over how sincerely the British believed that in the demoralization rationale. After all, it had failed at Guernica, the bombing which had only strengthened Basque resolve, and more to the point, it had failed the Blitz. The US condemned terror bombing as futile from the start. They conducted what they termed strategic bombing, and I mean that by the narrower sense of the phrase, whereby it means bombing attempts to degrade the enemy's warfighting capacity. Namely, it means targeting war material production and key resources such as oil or transport infrastructure and that sort of thing. Stuff that actually affects military matters. And you can contrast this with the way people often use the term strategic bombing, which simply means bombing from a high altitude, really. Anyway, they scaled priorities of targets on the basis of the impact on the German warfighting capacity. According to James Carroll, quote, "Scaling targets in this way, the Americans had neither the strategic nor tactical interest in purely civilian targets." End quote. The US, however, changed its tune, but given the ongoing evidence of strategic counterproductiveness attending the bombing of civilians, the question must be why. Lewis Mumford wrote that after the war, that by taking this method, these democratic governments sanctioned the dehumanized techniques of fascism. This was Nazism's firmest victory and democracy's most servile surrender. Was there, indeed, some sort of chain of infection where genocide is a disease incubated in the Great War and spread like influenza. I think there is a kernel of truth to this, but there are also more prosaic matters. After all, firestorms and extermination camps may have been innovations, but genocide was not, and Japan, a state little touched by the horrors of World War I, had been rampaging through China in a genocidal manner halfway between a traditional colonial genocide and the technological genocide that was soon to be widespread. There is a more prosaic explanation for the US turn to genocide. Up until that point, the strategic plan for the post-war world had called for the retention of a grand area under German hegemony. That planning changed as it became clear that the Soviets were winning against Germany, eventually transforming into an uneven global bipolar paradigm, which was the basis for the Cold War. Thus, the US began what was called area bombing, a conflation of putatively strategic bombing and the bombing of civilians, notably using incendiary bombs to set whole cities alight, killing many thousands in a single raid. Their first attacks against civilians in January 1945 were officially against strategic targets, but those chosen were located in densely populated areas, just as the British had chosen to locate their strategic targets in 1941. As John Kenneth Galbraith tells the story, by 1944, Franklin Roosevelt was doubtful about the efficacy of such areas. He wanted a civilian rule, and it was Galbraith, along with George Ball and Paul Nitzer, who formed the core of the operation. Galbraith's word, they found in essence that bombing, whether strategic or area bombing or terror bombing, was an expensive waste of war material. Industry was easily decentralized and machine tools were hard to damage with the ordnance of the time. Strategic bombing, and I'm quoting here, strategic bombing was designed to destroy the industrial base of the enemy and the morale of its people, and it did neither. That's Galbraith's words. In other words, it was actually counterproductive to any effort to win the war because it was horrendously expensive. Furthermore, the US engaged in acts of civilian mass murder, which no reference to strategic aims nor demoralization could rationalize. Dresden was a demilitarized city which, on February the 13th, 1945, had swelled to over twice its normal population of 650,000, with refugees choosing to shelter in a city which the Allies had no cause to bomb. Quote, "The first wave, consisting of nearly 250 British bombers carrying both high explosive and incendiary bombs, hit Dresden at 10 p.m. on the 13th. 3 hours later, the second wave of more than 500 British bombers carrying more than 650,000 incendiary bombs struck again. 10 hours later, at about noon, 360 American bombers attacked, dropping nearly 500 tons of high explosive and 300 tons of incendiary bombs. Also included in the American bomb loads were delayed action fuses designed to explode while rescue workers and firefighters were accompanying the American bombers were fighter planes that used machine guns to strafe masses of survivors trying to leave the burning city. It is difficult to see the strategic purpose of firebombing a city with no military significance. Strafing the fleeing refugees from such a city would surely be understood as a war crime and as an act of mass murder. It should be borne in mind that international humanitarian law is built on two cardinal principles, the first of which is the distinction between combatants and non-combatants. This principle predates, and for obvious reasons is not altered by, the theories of Duhet et al., who denied that there is a distinction between combatant and non-combatant. As Joanna Bork writes, quote, Article 25 of the Hague Convention of 1907 clearly stipulated that, quote, the attack by bombardment by whatever means of towns, villages, or buildings which are undefended is prohibited. And a protocol issued by the British in 1938 and passed by the League of Nations extended Article 25 to air raids, stating that, quote, the intentional bombing of civilian populations is illegal, objectives aimed at from the air must be legitimate military targets and must be identifiable, end quote. And then in 1945, in February, there was the initiation of what was known as Project Clarion, which was, according to Marcusen and Kopf, explicitly anti-civilian. Thousands of American bombers and fighters roamed the largely undefended skies over rural Germany, searching for small towns and villages to strafe and bomb at altitudes. These were the places to which the children of the industrial cities had been evacuated. Why then, one might ask, did the US go to such lengths to take so many lives, especially once the outcome of war was inevitable? In Japan, this question is even more acute. The US air campaign in Japan had killed about 600,000 civilians even before nuclear weapons were used. This was, if one can put such immense suffering into any meaningful context, considerably less than the number of civilians who died at Japanese hands. However, there are two aspects of gratuitousness which make these deaths and those suffered through atomic bombing unquestionably genocidal. First is that all but a tiny proportion of the civilian deaths occurred after it was clear to both sides that Japan had lost the war. In some circles, the US was aware as early as 1941 that the defeat of Axis was inevitable given time. Later, in the highest Japanese military circles, the truth became evident. As Cox writes, after the devastating loss of Saipan, which was on July the 9th, 1944, Army War Direction officers reached the conclusion that the war was lost and that hostilities must quickly be ended, particularly because Germany's days seemed numbered. The majority of US fatalities in the Pacific occurred after this point, and almost all of the civilian deaths occurred after March of 1945. By this stage of the war, US leaders were aware that the Japanese were seeking to surrender, and must have known that they could have been brought to terms that the US, as would later become apparent, found acceptable. The Japanese wanted guarantees regarding the emperor's status, and the US demanded unconditional surrender until after having dropped two atomic bombs. After that, however, they extended the desired guarantees. It has subsequently been pointed out that the US actually needed the emperor to retain authority in order to order a surrender which would have otherwise been extremely problematic to enforce. It is important to bear this in mind when dealing with the second factor, which demonstrates the genocidal nature of the saturation bombing campaign against Japan. That begins with the fact that the US cannot have had any reasonable surety that the mass killings of Japanese civilians would save the life of even one US individual. Indeed, the previously discussed study of the effects of strategic bombing on Germany would suggest that the use of such resources would be counterproductive. Admittedly, conditions were different in Japan, but that cuts both ways. On the one hand, it was a little easier to destroy Japanese war material production capacities. On the other hand, Japanese forces and even civilian society were very difficult to supply. By early 1945, the Japanese had less than 1 million tons of shipping left, not enough for the transport needs even of the main home islands. Diversion of resources from the interdiction and direct attack on military targets can only have been counterproductive, given that, as will be discussed, US leaders knew that they could avoid an armed invasion of Japan, with only acceptable concessions to the conditionality of surrender. The US only began a bombing campaign against Japanese railways as the war ended. As J.K. Galbraith put it, based on his findings, Japanese industry did not have the same recovery capacity as the Germans, yet the firebombing of Japanese cities was not a decisive factor in the war. The war in Asia was won by hard, slow progress up from the south and across the Pacific. Indeed, the gratuitousness of the firebombing campaign is easy to infer even from the summary of the US government's own strategic bombing survey. Quote, Japan had been critically wounded by military defeats, the destruction of the bulk of her merchant fleet, and almost complete blockade. The proper target, after an initial attack on aircraft engine plants, either to bring overwhelming pressure on her to surrender or to reduce her capability of resisting invasion, was the basic economic and social fabric of the country. And another quote, Even though the urban area attacks and attacks on specific industrial plants contributed a substantial percentage to the overall decline in Japan's economy, in many segments of that economy their effects were duplicative. Most of the oil refineries were out of oil, the alumina plants were out of bauxite, the steel mills lacking in ore and coke, the munitions plants low in steel and aluminium. Japan's economy was in large measure being destroyed twice over, once by cutting off imports and secondly by air attack. A further tightening of Japan's shipping situation, so as to eliminate remaining imports from Korea and coastwise and inter-island shipping, coupled with an attack on Japan's extremely vulnerable railroad network, would have extended and accumulated the effects of the shipping attack already made. Now, remember here that the deliberate destruction of, quote, the basic economic and social fabric of the country, end quote, is exactly the sort of behavior characterized by Lemkin as genocide. But this language is distinctly sanitized, leaving out the important consideration of the deliberate maximization of civilian deaths. It is worth examining the nature of the aerial bombardment as it evolved during World War II, because the weapon used here was not the conventional high explosive, nor even the incendiary bomb as such, but rather the firestorm, which should really be viewed as an unconventional weapon of mass destruction, more akin in its effect to the use of atomic weapons than to previous aerial bombardments. As mentioned, the bombing of Guernica was greatly abhorred by the Allies, but the US was also consistently condemnatory of the Japanese practice of bombing Chinese cities. The Department of State condemned the practice in September of 1937 and in March and June of 1938. On the latter occasion, the wording included the mention of, quote, the slaughter of civilian populations, end quote. Roosevelt himself also condemned the practice in October of 1937, and in June of 1938, a resolution was introduced to the Senate condemning this crime against humanity. But if the indiscriminate dropping of individual bombs on a civilian population is slaughter, then the all-consuming, inescapable effects of a firestorm in an urban center must surely belong in another category altogether, closer to that of nuclear annihilation or extermination camps. The firestorm effect was discovered by accident in the bombing of Hamburg, although the destruction it wrought was intended and desired. The Royal Air Force was working with the United States Army Air Force, who were supporting, they mixed high explosive and incendiary bombs in a very dense pattern with the intention of overwhelming firefighting forces in the way described already, so that uncontrollable fires would continue destruction beyond that wrought directly. This might nowadays be referred to as a force multiplier, or more accurately, a tonnage multiplier. It worked exactly as intended, but the physical effect was not one of individual fires spreading uncontrollably, igniting one building after another. It was that of a sea of fire, a single exterminating incinerator over 2 kilometers in diameter. In an event that was to be repeated many times before its end, masses were burned, asphyxiated, or boiled to death. The effects are best known in the Anglophone world from Kurt Vonnegut's laconic descriptions of the aftermath of the Dresden firestorm, when, as a POW, he helped to clear out the corpse mines, which is what the bomb shelters had become. As James Carroll writes, the Hamburg firestorm saw the open initiation of a new way of war. Quote, methods that would have been condemned out of hand if carried out by armies on the ground were becoming routine from the air. After Hamburg, civilian casualties would no longer be seen as collateral, they were essential. End quote. The RAF dropped the pretense that its bombing of civilians was a means of dehousing workers, and the US began to embrace the same logic and methods. When Japanese cities were firebombed 2 years after the Hamburg firestorm, the facts were well understood, and there was some considerable eagerness to see how well such firebombing would work in the far more flammable cities of Japan. In Tokyo of March 1945, they managed to create something that, quote, dwarfed even the firestorms that consumed Hamburg and Dresden, a so-called sweep conflagration. Although eventual death tolls of civilians were similar in Germany and Japan, in Japan the slaughter of civilians was far more systematic and focused, using less than 1/8 of the tonnage dropped on Germany. The size of targeted cities became ever smaller, the destruction ever more comprehensive, until by August they were firebombing cities of less than 50,000. As Dower reports, quote, one of General Douglas MacArthur's key aides, Brigadier General Bonner Fellers, frankly described the US air raids against Japan as one of the most ruthless and barbaric killings of non-combatants in all history, end quote. Before Hiroshima, quote, a communication sent to all AAF officers flying missions against Japanese cities defined what the overall goal had become. We intend to seek out and destroy the enemy wherever he or she is, in the greatest possible numbers, in the shortest possible time. For us, there are no civilians in Japan. End quote. Curtis LeMay later retrospectively echoed this logic. Quote, there are no innocent civilians. It is their government, and you are fighting a people. You are not fighting an armed force anymore. End quote. To be clear about this, they are stating, as if for a fact, that all of the people of a nation, including the newborn infants once again, the school children, the invalids, the elderly, are in some manner military targets. By any reckoning, that is a lie. Any actions based on this rationale were war crimes, in that they deliberately and exclusively targeted a group clearly defined as non-combatants. The attempt to redefine non-combatants can only be an aggravating matter in that it reveals a clear degree of premeditated intent. Nor can it be said that this is an isolated result of brutality, the brutality and totality of World War II. As we've already seen, William Westmoreland in 1969 claimed that there were no civilians in designated free fire zones. One might be tempted to see this as military illogic, a blindness caused by the attractions of maximizing the destructive potential of a finite amount of firepower. There is, however, a strategic logic behind such acts, although not a military one. This logic would lead one to seek to weaken an entire population, not to achieve a given end or ends, nor envisaging a particular limitation in time, but with an open-ended commitment to achieving and deepening dominance through enfeebling the whole population, creating a potentially inescapable dependence or effective defenselessness. In other words, to quote a description of an ultimately very similar situation, quote, the damage they do against the regime is collateral damage in a war against society. That is how a writer in 1999 described the sanctions regime in Iraq. Under Lemkin's conception, the term for this sort of logic is genocide, and it is the only extant term that gives meaning to such actions. In legal terms, the firebombing would clearly fit under the terms of the UN Convention as genocide. And I do not think that intentionality could be denied, given the repetition, the calculation, and the certain foreknowledge of the effects, the absence of any sound military rationale, and the explicit admissions of deliberate and systematic killing of civilians en masse. Now, I'm going to turn to the horrendously complicated subject of the Korean War. I'll just briefly point out that the US unilaterally decided in 1945 to divide the country and ended up occupying the southern part of it. The southern part was in fact the part with the most communists, and the northern part was the part with the most Christians, which was rather unfortunate. But anyway, the entirety of Korea, as the war was ended, saw the spontaneous uprising of people's committees, which were in some ways left-leaning. They certainly believed in land reform, and they were against Japanese imperialism, and they felt that those who had collaborated with the Japanese deserved to have some of their property taken off them and redistributed. And they also felt that Japanese property should be redistributed. Now, when the US walked in, of course, they found all of this very alarming and rather communist-oriented. As historian Bruce Cummings, who I'll use a lot in this, tells the story, quote, The American occupation chose to bolster the status quo and resist a thorough reform of colonial legacies. It immediately ran into monumental opposition from the mass of South Koreans. Most of the first year of the occupation, 1945 to 1946, was given over to suppression of many people's committees that had emerged in the provinces. This provoked a massive rebellion that spread over four provinces in the fall of 1946. End quote. The US response was brutal and involved the first of a seven-year-long series of massacres that would take hundreds of thousands of lives. On the island of Jeju, completely cut off from any Democratic People's Republic of Korea involvement, that is North Korea, I'm just going to refer to it as DPRK from now on, or North Korea, rebellion occurred in response to the violent repression of a political demonstration in March of 1948. The response, which involved U.S. personnel, the Republic of Korea Army, which is Republic of Korea is South Korea, and right-wing paramilitaries brought over from the mainland, was one of incredible brutality. Jeju had a population of 300,000, and at the peak of the rebellion had only 30,000 so-called guerrillas. In fact, the armed corps of the real guerrillas, who had small arms, numbered only 500, and the rest were peasants armed with farm implements and sharpened bamboo, resisting the widespread destruction of villages. This period saw 20,000 homes destroyed. And they were resisting as well the murders and massacres of those individuals or communities deemed to be supporters of the rebellion. The normal enumeration of civilian deaths on Jeju is given as, quote, more than 30,000. 33,000 was the amount admitted to by the Republic of Korea official news agency itself. Estimates of 100,000 deaths are not known. However, a recent study suggests 80,000 deaths, more than one quarter of the total population. In Yosu, Republic of Korea Army troops who refused to deploy to Jeju formed the basis of another rebellion, again brutally suppressed with U.S. involvement and supervision. This unorganized rebellion of the ROK Army's 14th Regiment in Yosu was soon suppressed under the direction of KMAG, which is Korea Military Advisory Group. That's the U.S. Korean Military Advisory Group. But the operations were accompanied by widespread violence by rightists against innocent civilians, as was the case in Jeju. The rebels executed hundreds of police, officials, and landlords. But even after the rebellion was quelled, the rightist revenge was brutal. A U.S. source reported that, quote, loyal troops were shooting people who they had the slightest suspicion of giving cooperation to the communist uprising, end quote. About 1,000 Yosu rebels fled to the mountains and formed the nucleus of a more organized guerrilla movement. A CIA estimate put guerrilla numbers at 3,500 to 6,000 in early 1949, but many were armed only with clubs and bamboo spears. Those small arms that were used seemed entirely of Japanese or US origin, with no Soviet weapons ever being captured. The methods of repression remained similar under the continued leadership of James Houseman, who styled himself the father of the Korean army. The U.S. had made it clear to Rhee through his close associate Goodfellow, who was a figure, a former ad man and CIA operative, they made it clear to Rhee that continued U.S. support was contingent on his continued brutal repression of guerrilla activity. On July 25th, 1950, North Korean troops crossed into South Korea. Now, the events surrounding this are, to say the least, anomalous, and I will discuss them at another time because it's a very complicated issue. But what I can say is that anyone who claims to know that North Korean troops conducted an unprovoked attack across the border on July the 25th is a liar. We don't really know exactly what happened, and there is seemingly completely contradictory evidence. Anyway, one incident mentioned by Brian Wilson was the incident at Nogun Rhee, which happens shortly afterwards. On July 25th, 50, Korean villagers were forced by US soldiers to evacuate their homes and move south. The next day, villagers continued south along the road. When the villagers reached the vicinity of Nogunri, the soldiers stopped them at a roadblock and ordered the group onto the railroad tracks, where the soldiers searched their personal belongings. Although the soldiers found no prohibited items, such as weapons or other military contraband, the soldiers ordered an air attack upon the villagers via radio communications with US aircraft. Shortly afterwards, planes flew over and dropped bombs and fired machine guns, killing approximately 100 villagers on the railroad tracks. After the initial attack, the refugees fled into a culvert and a tunnel beneath the bridge. US forces set up machine guns at either end of the culvert and the tunnel. For over 3 entire days, the machine gunners killed those who tried to leave, killing, according to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Korea, the TRCK, an additional 300 individuals. Quote, "There was a lieutenant screaming like a madman, 'Fire on everything! Kill them all,'" recalls 7th Cavalry veteran Joe Jackman. "I don't know if they were soldiers or what. Kids. There was kids out there. It didn't matter what it was. 8 to 80. Blind, crippled, or crazy. They shot them all." Soldiers with small arms would, as time passed, approach the culvert to pick off any survivors. A survivor, who was 12 at the time, said, "The American soldiers played with our lives like boys playing with flies." Bruce Cummings believes that there was actually a concerted effort to ensure that there were no surviving witnesses. We know that these events occurred because of eyewitness statements, both those of survivors and those of 35 veterans who corroborate these events. Further corroboration exists in the bullet holes that remain to be seen, though plastered over, in the culvert and the tunnel to this day. This was, as Brian Wilson points out, only one of many massacres that occurred in South Korea. There were massacres of political dissidents, who sometimes weren't even political dissidents, but rather hapless farmers who'd been registered in an organization of those who were politically suspect. About 300,000 of them were in this organization, and it seems that most of them were massacred by South Korean forces. There were massacres behind the lines of civilians by US forces as well as by South Korean forces. When US and South Korean forces crossed into North Korean territory, there were massacres occurring there by both of those parties. There were paramilitaries carrying out massacres as well. And in addition to this, the US was constantly dropping bombs on North Korea systematically, killing civilians and destroying civilian infrastructure with maximum effect once again. And then there was Indochina. Now, I think that Brian Wilson's words summarize a lot about Indochina. And I would argue that Wilson was one of very few among the millions of US personnel cycled through Indochina who actually really saw what was going on. He, through his experiences, he pierced a veil and saw the fundamental nature of the genocide. Most US personnel never witnessed, let alone partook in, major atrocity. But the strong association of the, quote, "Vietnam War," end quote, with US atrocities is not the product of liars, nor of some elevated moral stance that caused US personnel to be far more honest in reporting the inevitable lapses which occur in war. The association comes about because these atrocities were prolific. The recent experience of Nick Turse and Deborah Nelson, a scholar and a journalist, illustrates the point. They travelled to part of Gwangnam province to find the site of a massacre detailed in US investigation files. They had an uncertain location, but in 3 days of looking for the site, they were shown a total of 5 massacre sites where a total of 8 different massacres had occurred. 5 were committed by US personnel. They were still unable to find the site of the massacre they had set out to find. Quote, "We thought we'd be looking for a needle in a haystack of hamlets, not a haystack of massacres." This too is indicative of genocide, for the factors which lead to such widespread mass murder were not cultural but rather systemic results of deliberate choices. US personnel were primed through indoctrination and then situated in such a manner as to generate a predisposition towards atrocities. US personnel were placed in what Robert J. Lifton has referred to as atrocity-producing situations. This was a symptomatic component of genocide, and very similar behaviors can be observed in Iraq. So that's where I'm going to leave this lengthy introductory lecture. As I continue, I want to explore those atrocity-producing situations, how they might be manufactured, and the other ways in which the US is focused on killing as many civilians as possible. I want to explore this and put it in the context of genocide as a theoretical concept that can give us an understanding of why someone would undertake such behavior. In the next lecture, I'm going to be looking at the collateral murder video and looking at it for what it can tell us about the broader situation, because the significance of what is occurring in that video seems to have been rather lost. I'll leave with a track from David Rovics, whose pages I'll provide links to on the blog and the Facebook page and the SoundCloud page. Right, hope to catch you next time.
I've seen you in the markets, I've seen you in the streets, and at your political conventions. Talking of your crusade, talking of your nation, and other things too terrible to mention. And you proclaim your Christianity, you proclaim your love of God, you talk of apple pie and ma. I've just got one question, and I want an answer, tell me, who would Jesus bomb? Jesus would bomb the Syrians, 'cause they're not Jews like him. Maybe Jesus would bomb the Afghans on some kind of vengeful whim. Maybe Jesus would drive an M1 tank and he would shoot Saddam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I've seen you on the TV and on the battleships. I've seen you in the house upon the hill. And I've heard you talking about making the world safer and about all the men you have to kill. And you speak so glibly about your civilization and how you have the moral higher ground. While halfway around the world, your explosives smash the buildings. If you could only hear the sound. But maybe Jesus would sell landmines and turn on his electric chair. Maybe Jesus would show no compassion for his enemies in the lands way over there. Maybe Jesus would have flown the planes that killed the kids in Vietnam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I hear you shout with confidence as you praise the Lord and you talk about this God you know so well. You talk of Armageddon and your final victory when all the evil forces go to hell. Well, you'd best hope you've chosen wisely on the right side of the Lord, and when you die, your conscience, it is clear. You'd best hope your atom bombs are better than the sword and the time when your reckoning is here. I don't think Jesus would send gunships into Bethlehem or jets to raise the towns of Timorese. I don't think Jesus would lend money to dictators or drive those SUVs. I don't think Jesus would ever have dropped a single ounce of napalm. Who would Jesus bomb? Jesus find? Who would Jesus find?